So, welcome everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. Before we begin, if there is anyone who is new or anybody who is not new, who has any questions just simply about the practices that we did this morning, the practices of mindfulness meditation, mindfulness of the body and the breath, sitting and walking. So if anybody is not clear about the practice, that is most essential. Because what you may hear in a talk, for many people, it's in one ear and out the other. So the most important thing is that you take the practice with you. The teachings are just there to support you in understanding what you can do with the practice. But without the cultivation of mindfulness, without developing a mind that has some degree of clarity, openness, and some capacity to be objective and clear about whatever is arising both inside and outside, it is very difficult to heal and transform oneself. So while there are many teachings to listen to and many books to read, it's really all about the practice that will really benefit you. So are there any questions? So if you have a question, please don't be embarrassed. So it's all clear. Yeah, it is. I mean, the practice is fairly simple in its instructions, much more difficult to do in actuality. But good. So this morning's a little different. Many of you know that it's been over a month since I've been here. And so I want to take this time this morning to talk about a little, especially our visit to Plum Village. When we left here in the beginning of June, we first went to North Carolina, where every year we do a retreat at the Southern Dharma Retreat Center. And the retreat has been called for many years now, Unfettering the Natural Mind. And it really is a wonderful week-long retreat. Where really it's all about the practice of meditation, and especially the practices that lead to a deeper understanding of the nature of mind, the nature of reality, the nature of thoughts in a very deep and profound way. Southern Dharma Retreat Center is a small retreat center. We have about 26 people who come for the week, most of which now are members, many who travel from Florida for the retreat, but it's a very isolated retreat center up in the mountains of North Carolina, so it's very conducive. There's a lot of natural beauty, a creek running through the property, quiet. So it's a wonderful place to practice. And then from there, we flew from Charlotte to Barcelona, Spain, overnight. And then jumped in a car and drove 7 hours to Plum Village in southern France. Now, I believe probably most people know who Thich Nhat Hanh is, right? Sort of one of the most well-known, if along with the Dalai Lama, well-known teachers, writers, about Buddhism and mindfulness of our current time. And Plum Village is his, I might say, his original community in France. After the Vietnam War ended, he was living in the outskirts of Paris, and after the war ended, and he was he realized his temporary exile in France was now going to be permanent because the new government in Vietnam did not want him back. So after several years of realizing that and realizing he had to make a life in the West, he, and at that time, now she's known as Chong Kung, his noble assistant, then known as Cao Feng, resettled in southern France, where they purchased these two old farmhouses, stone, fairly dilapidated farms. And the upper one was called Upper Hamlet, and the lower one was called Lower Hamlet. And when I first went there in 83, 84, it was basically Thich Nhat Hanh and then Sister Fung and one assistant living in the old stone farmhouse in the Upper Hamlet, and then a Vietnamese family down below, about a half-hour walk down the road, living in the Lower Hamlet, trying to raise so-called Oriental vegetables to sell to the in the markets of Bordeaux. So it started out quite small. And primarily, they lived sort of alone, and in the summertime would be often visited, well, they were visited by many overseas Vietnamese, who would basically come not only for Dharma, but also for kind of a cultural experience with their children, and they really were very much supportive of kind of helping the overseas Vietnamese stay with their roots. So there was a lot of that in the early days. But what happened, of course, over time is Thich Nhat Hanh became quite the thing. His books sold widely, and many people were interested in coming to him. So over time, in the 80s and 90s, Plum Village kind of took off. And in those days, in the 80s and 90s, when I used to go quite often with my family, every other year, it was primarily a lay community. Thich Nhat Hanh had founded something called the Order of Interbeing. I won't go into that. There have been talks, and many of you know about the Order of Interbeing. We have over 30 participants in that community, in our Florida community. But it was primarily a lay community, with the core of it being members of the Order of Interbeing. But over time, that changed. It grew and grew. I mean, where there might have been 100 or 200 people coming for the summer open, there were now 800, 1,000, 1,500. I mean, quite large and quite quite a melange of activities. But also people came, some wanting to be monks and nuns. And so over time, there were more people who were monks and nuns who made a stronger commitment to being there than lay people and members, and also many Vietnamese, overseas Vietnamese, and even Vietnamese from Vietnam would come there to be ordained by him. So by the mid to late 90s, and especially in this century, Plum Village really became a monastic community. With the Upper Hamlet really being the monastery for the monks, and the Lower Hamlet being the nunnery for the nuns, and a community of over 100 monks and nuns. So on the one hand, it's this monastic community, but on the other hand, throughout the year, they not only welcome guests, but several times during the year they would have retreats. Some of the retreats would be very open, sort of like the Woodstock. There's a summer family retreat for 4 weeks, which if you ever want to have a Woodstock experience in the context of mindfulness and Dharma, I would recommend going there. I mean, it's quite a wonderful gathering of people from all over the world. It's quite something what goes on there. But also at the times during the year, especially in the winter time, in the spring, there would be more kind of meditation, Dharma retreats that the community would put on. So the community has always had this kind of, I wouldn't call it a tension, but between on the one hand being a place for monastics to live and train and live a monastic life, but at the same time being very open to you know, the popularity and the interest in Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching in the community, to kind of put on retreats and take care of them. So it's sort of a hybrid. But it definitely, because of Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching about community and the essence of that the Dharma needs to be practiced within a community, and his commitment to creating communities in which monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen live together and practice together, it's a real experiment in kind of what this kind of a community of mindfulness might look like, even though it is a residential community. So what brought us here this year was this was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Order of Interbeing, which Thich Nhat Hanh founded with six of his young students in Vietnam and Saigon in the mid-60s. This was the 50th anniversary, and so they put on what was called a Vulture Peak Gathering retreat for 21 days in June. And there were, again, members of the order from all over the world who had come to participate in this retreat. Because of a prior commitment to this Southern Dharma retreat, we weren't able to go till the 12th, so it was a little more than halfway over. But not only Angie and I were there, several members from Tampa, several members from Naples and Fort Myers, and one of our members from Miami were also there. So it was quite wonderful for me to kind of come back, and I really haven't been there in probably 15, 16 years, to come back, but also have people of our community also there. Well, let me bring them up before I continue. So there are two of them here, Diane and Angie. Why don't you just come on up, and do we have a microphone? Since, again, I have a long history both with the Order of Interbeing and with the Plum Village community, my view of it is a little different. So these are two members who had never been there, so I'm interested in their impressions, their take on things, what they found meaningful, what might be relevant to us. Again, it is a different kind of community. I mean, we really here in Tampa and in Florida, Florida Community of Mindfulness and other places, we really are more of an urban Dharma community of lay people who work and have families and just come when they can. But again, we really put a great emphasis on building community. Plum Village is a residential community. Right, so it has, as I said, 100 monks and nuns who live there year-round, as well as people who come for a week, for 2 weeks, for 3 weeks, for 4 weeks. Some people come and stay for 6 months or a year or 2 years. It's a wide variety of people, but it is residential, so it is a very different kind of community than ours. Even though I think some of the major principles of building community are relevant to both. So before I say more. Speak.
Dear friends, is this on? Working? Okay, good. It was really something I've always wanted to do, is to go to Plum Village. Fred obviously was there in the early days and had a really wonderful deep connection, but we've been so busy with the center and really creating community here that until this opportunity arose, I really hadn't had a chance to visit. So as Fred was saying, it was quite interesting to first be at Southern Dharma for 7 days, where if you're familiar with our path of teaching, there's mindful living, Dharma path, and wisdom. And this retreat is very much a wisdom path retreat. So very concentrated in the mind, looking deeply at the nature of mind and training the mind. So going from this experience, as Fred said, within 2 days of travel to walking into the upper hamlet where we stayed, which is where the monks stay and where Thich Nhat Hanh is, and suddenly to be in this Bien Woodstock type situation was quite interesting. I was a little speechless at first because we had arrived late, so most people had been there in community together already for almost 2 weeks. And what initially arose for me was a little bit of a feeling of an outsider and a little bit of shyness, which was interesting. But immediately we were joined to a family. Families are very big at Plum Village, and it's a way of creating community with people from all over the world by putting them into families of 20, 30 people for the duration. And it's a real point of connection. So very quickly within that family, Fred knew a lot of people, so immediately he felt, I think, he was very connected. But it gave me a real sense of connection, and to be with so many people practicing mindfulness was just really, truly lovely. It was interesting that we were among a fairly small number of people from the U.S. So there were many Italians, Irish, many Vietnamese, Japanese, people from everywhere that were creating community in their areas in so many creative ways. And again, as we came to Plum Village, not knowing what to expect, you know, my experience in the past has been with this community, and all we've done, in many cases, for the first time, there aren't other lay communities in the U.S. who have their own center, who have the website, who have the three paths of teaching like we do. So it's felt somewhat like an island sometime. And how revealing it was for me, and how wonderful to suddenly be in the presence of people from all over the world who are doing somewhat similar and many different things, and to suddenly feel part of this lineage of Thich Nhat Hanh. I really hadn't felt that connection before, but suddenly to be sitting with a group of people in Italy who raised money to buy a property, to fix it up, people doing something similar in Singapore, people doing things in Canada, hearing from Vietnamese who in Vietnam they called it guerrilla sangha, they have to be very much under the radar with the government because of practicing in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, but how beautifully and how committed they are to the practice. So in so many lovely ways to see how what Thich Nhat Hanh has created has really blossomed. We had affinity groups. We did a lot of sharing. And what we learned, it was interesting. You're always interested to see, well, this is what we do in our community. What do other people do in their community? And, you know, I learned there are communities that have wonderful days of mindfulness, that have retreats. I didn't see anything like our three paths of practice. And I even noticed it was interesting. He wouldn't say it himself, but Fred was quite respected and held in just very high esteem by everyone in the community. He had been one of the first Westerners ordained and certainly was the senior OI person at the retreat. And not only that, I think it's just the wisdom and the depth of practice that he brings was so obvious with the panels he served on, just even how he connected in our family. So, you know, there was just a lot of recognition and honoring and appreciation for what he's done in the community here. There was a lot of interest in building community. I led a group. There were affinity groups where people could just sign up to say, I'm interested in talking about that. And we had a tremendous number of people come to the affinity group that wanted to know about building and sustaining community. So they were very interested, again, in our paths of practice, of teaching, of just kind of what are the nuts and bolts of how you create community. We're a little unusual, I think, in that we have such a strong lay community here. Versus a lot of what I saw in Plum Village is the monastics have their communities, but most other sanghas are renting space and a little bit of a feeling of, the monastics kind of have the primary centers and the lay people kind of congregate perhaps for retreats there. So again, I think what we're doing, it really enriches the OI internationally, and I think, again, there was a lot of enthusiasm and interest in how together we can really strengthen it. So overall, it was a wonderful experience, and again, I come back feeling just so connected with the lineage and who we are as part of this greater Sangha, and how wonderful it will be for us to stay connected with our Sangha brothers and sisters all over the world, and how enriching that will be for all of us, how much we can be a benefit, I think, to so many others in this tradition, and how much we can benefit from the practices that we saw there, particularly of community. I think we have a wonderful practice of community here, but when I felt new and felt welcomed into the family, it made me realize how here at our Sangha, sometimes we take for granted, if we've been around for a while, that we know each other. But people come here who are new all the time, too. And I really thought, you know, what other things could we do, whether it's through the family or something else, to be sure that everyone who comes in has that same experience. So there are a lot of interesting things to think about for our Sangha. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Let me just explain some logistics things before Diane, because so when we talk about Plum Village, we're actually these days talking about there are three major hamlets. There's what's called Upper Hamlet, which is a whole community in and of itself, has its own large meditation hall, a kitchen, monastics, hundreds of people are staying there. I mean, people are just staying everywhere, so it has its own accommodations. And it is primarily where men and couples, right, are placed. Down the hill is Lower Hamlet, which is where the nuns live, and that's pretty much for women. Okay. Then there is about 20, 30 minutes away something called New Hamlet. And I'm not sure, it seems to be nuns there too, but I'm not sure in terms of lay people who stayed there. So you have these three major hamlets, okay, as well as people are staying in other kinds of places around, because there are just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people at this retreat. And so what you have is, on different days, the formal talks that go on every morning and presentations are held in different hamlets. So if it was in Lower Hamlet that day, all of us from Upper Hamlet would go down to Lower Hamlet and also bring our own lunches. Okay? Because Lower Hamlet would be feeding their own people, or the Lower Hamlet people would be coming up to Upper Hamlet. And those two hamlets are kind of walkable. New Hamlet, they'd be bused in. There would be a big bus that would pick them up and drive them either to Lower or Upper. So basically, the retreat is kind of moving, kind of for the major part of the morning and early afternoon, to one of the three hamlets. Otherwise, you're pretty much in your own hamlet, right? Because that's where you come back in the mid-afternoon. And so your family groups, there are all kinds of other presentations and meditations morning and night, are all going on within your hamlet. So I'm just trying to give you a sense of what it's like. You're sort of in your own hamlet that has its own schedule. It's where you're eating, where you're meditating, where your family groups are, where your affinity groups are, where there are different kind of panels and presentations going on. And usually once a day, everyone who's at the retreat comes together in one of the hamlets. So people could also have a very different experience depending on where they are. Being an Upper Hamlet, I would say definitely male energy, right? Go down to lower Hamlet, and I would say more female energy. I'm not sure about New Hamlet, but so it's one can be there and have a very, I think, different experience because of the energies of the place, but also because it's different people and who are giving the talks and presentations also. So I just wanted to kind of give you a sense of the lay of the land in Plum Village. It's not just one village. Yes. Yes, Angie.
Just one more point I wanted to add, which reminded me, because we were in Upper Hamlet, that is where Thich Nhat Hanh stays. So he has his small house in Upper Hamlet. And so throughout the retreat, his attendants would bring him out. He's in a wheelchair, really doesn't have the power of speech that I could see, but has a very profound, intense gaze and will do a bow. And just to be in his presence, it feels at this point like pure presence. You know, we might be sitting in the meditation hall and he might be wheeled in. We might be doing walking meditation and sitting with him on a hill outside, and he's drinking tea with his one hand. And then one day there was a small group of maybe 12 or 15 of us in a small shrine room, and Thich Nhat Hanh was wheeled in, and we all sat in meditation. So It's certainly a time of transition with teaching because he can't teach, but his presence is still very strong, and it was really wonderful to be in there and touch that.
I'll begin by just saying, dear Thai, dear Sangha, because when at Plum Village, whenever anybody was addressing a group of people, whether it was in our family groups or a teacher giving a Dharma talk or somebody on a panel, they would begin always by saying, dear Thai. So as Angie said, his presence was just palpable there. Actually, Sister Chong Kong gave a Dharma talk on the three bodies of the Buddha, and one of the first things she said was that all of us practicing in Thai's tradition are his continuation body, and that certainly brought home to me, too, how much everything that was being done there in Plum Village and that we were experiencing, and really much of what we experience here too, is all because of Thai. This was my first time at Plum Village. I stayed in Lower Hamlet with the nuns, and I must say that the food there is probably better, as Fred pointed out, than to us when we were there, than in the Upper Hamlet where the monks were cooking. And it's probably cleaner too, so those are definitely benefits. You know, I really went trying to have no expectations. I'd been hearing about Plum Village for probably 20 years, both from reading about it and from talking with Sangha friends who had been there. But I really wanted to go with a very open mind. I think the first thing that struck me was just the beauty of the place and the sense of its ancientness and oldness. As Angie said, it's just a series of old stone buildings, very old stone buildings. In Lower Hamlet, there are also beautiful gardens, and it was still spring, so there were many flowers in bloom. There's a large bell tower. There's a beautiful lotus pond. It just... you know, when you first arrive there, just the visual setting is very settling, and it's set in a beautiful countryside with rolling hills, little winding roads. I was with Betsy Arizu and a member from Miami, Rosaria, and we rented a car, and I said, you know, as we were driving down these little winding roads through the fields, I said, boy, do I ever feel French, you know, it just had that feeling of, now I'm really in France. But in Plum Village, it was really the place, the setting, and the people. The monastic presence is certainly there. And, you know, the monastics are a varied lot, sort of just like us. In Lower Hamlet, there were a lot of quite young Vietnamese nuns who just had a wonderfully bubbly presence about them. I mean, they were sort of like teenage girls, just, you know, happy and giggly. And then there were also two people who really, whose presence really struck me were Sister Annabelle and Sister Gina, two Western nuns who have been there for many, many years, I think, since the 80s, and were obviously senior presences there, and Sister Gina was actually the nun who led my family group and had wonderful stories to tell. So the monastics are a wonderful presence. You know, I really got the sense, too, with the monastics that while they are practicing deeply, they also have the same, and I don't want to call it struggles, but there is a tension also between deepening their spiritual practice and finding the time to devote to that and energy, and yet take care with mindfulness of all the many, many responsibilities that they have, because they do have a lot of work to do. And it just struck me that in some ways they are, they have the same challenges that we do, both in our personal lives and in our community. It definitely was a highlight for me to see Fred, so honored. There was a festival one afternoon where they celebrated the 50 years of OI that Fred and Shantam Seth emceed, they called it. And there were skits and little play, and there were presentations of beautiful flowering plants, one to Ty, although Ty was not there, but somebody received it for him, one to Sister Chung Kong, and one for Fred. And if I remember the wording correctly, what they said was that Fred was the Bodhisattva who took Ty's teachings to the West. And, you know, it was like, our Fred? And that was in front of everybody. The other thing that really, or one other thing that really struck me, as Angie talked about, was meeting people from all over the world who are doing this work. I was particularly interested in what Dharma programs people have instituted in their different sanghas. What was very interesting to me was, because Fred had actually been on a panel where he had talked a little bit about our community, but didn't have time to go into a lot of detail. So when people would learn that I was from Florida, they would want to know more about FCM, so as well as trying to find out what they were doing in their sanghas, I would describe some of what we were doing and our intensives. And I won't say people were shocked, but maybe the word is startled to find out that we bring teachings from other traditions into our Dharma programs. It really was quite clear that many of the Thich Nhat Hanh sanghas throughout the world practice exclusively and strictly using Thich Nhat Hanh practices. And I think it just hadn't occurred to many of them that you might bring in practices from other traditions. But it made me realize how fortunate we are and how rich our practice is to be able to draw upon all the Buddhist traditions. It also, because there was this sort of startled reaction, it made me reflect on, well, is this so unusual? And you know, are we not sort of, are we straying? Are we not being orthodox? But, you know, when I reflected on it, I realized that there always has been, as Fred has told us, and was really clear there too, that Thai has always been an experimenter and an innovator, and that made me think, if anybody's being true to his spirit, it's us, by being innovative. Then the other thing that really struck me was all the wonderful work that's being done throughout the world, as Angie said. You know, I mean, they're just story upon story of what people are doing. And I think I came away with just sort of a renewed understanding or appreciation that, you know, there's the Gatha, peace in oneself, peace in the world. That there are people all over the world trying to find peace in themselves and institute programs that will bring healing and transformation and peace to other people. So I'm not going to say that I really think, well, maybe I do think there can be peace in the world, but I think there are growing pockets of peace in the world that it's very inspiring.
Thank you.
So thank you, Ed, and please stay here because maybe there'll be some questions. So Plum Village, as was said, the kind of people who come there, there are people sort of like us who are, could be anywhere in the world, that are very active in building communities, building sanghas, but they're also... and in their own right, maybe doing interesting things, but there are also a lot of individuals who just have been very inspired, turned on by the teachings in Thich Nhat Hanh, who kind of see Plum Village and the communities as like their touchstone, but maybe doing kind of aid work in or special kind of work in Bhutan or India or social activism, environmental work here. There are just lots of individuals who are just doing very meaningful, wonderful things that aren't really part of, you know, formal sanghas like this because of their life or whatever, that are also there and part of this kind of large international community inspired by the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh and again, see Plum Village. Because Plum Village is, you know, it's sort of like, until you go there, you can't quite understand it, but it's just an unusual place, you know, and a very wonderful place. And just a lot of people come there to be inspired, to be recharged, to learn, to heal. It's a kind of one of these, it's just this kind of awakened place, you know, and that people for all various kinds of reasons end up there or pass through there. And so one of the things I always loved about going there beside, and this is, I think, what people were talking about with all the talking that goes on. There are those of us who are used to silent retreats. Whenever they go to Plum Village or one of the Thich Nhat Hanh's retreats historically, I say, don't be fooled by the word retreat. If you're expecting a silent retreat, you will be disappointed and frustrated because a lot of it is about community and a lot of it is about connecting with people. And so there's a lot of connecting going on, which is kind of wonderful, you know. Again, all different kinds of people in different kind of places and different parts of the world. And people want to talk with each other and share with each other and find out who each other is. So that certainly is, yeah. So, and just a quick response, I guess what Diane has said is, you know, the secret is out. But we are a different kind of, you see, when I encountered Thich Nhat Hanh in the 70s and 80s, there was no Plum Village tradition. There was no Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. There was really just him. And I had the good fortune to encounter him at a time where I could spend a lot of time with him and hear his teachings very directly. But I think what Diane is talking about is that most people who are involved with the Thich Nhat Hanh Plum Village communities now throughout the world have really come into contact with it in the last 10, 15 years or so, when there has become a Plum Village tradition and kind of a Thich Nhat Hanh teachings. And so often the case, because it really, I mean, over the years, I meet so many people, especially in the last 15, 20 years, who would say, oh, they're students of Thich Nhat Hanh. I said, oh, wonderful. You know, tell me about your experience with him. Well, they really have never had a personal experience with him. You know, they've been to maybe some retreats where they've been one of 1,200 or 1,500 people. Do you see what I'm saying? So it's a very different kind of experience. And I'm not saying it's in a negative way, but just my experience was very different. And as Diane alluded, if there anybody who was an innovator, it was Thich Nhat Hanh. If there was anybody who broke out of his Vietnamese Buddhist tradition quite powerfully and really went new ways to renew and revise the order of interbeing itself, it was a great experiment in creating a new Buddhist order in which monks and nuns and laymen and lay people were equal. And the 14 mindfulness trainings are his way to synthesize traditional Buddhist 5 and 10, what we call the precepts and the bodhisattva precepts, and put them together in a very relevant way. So the Thich Nhat Hanh I encountered was an innovator, an experimenter, and somebody who was very open to all Buddhist traditions. If you look in the chart of the Order of Interbeing, it says quite clearly, we draw our sustenance from all the traditions of Buddhism. And if people know anything about Asian Buddhism, it is very delineated. Different traditions, different denominations, different countries. So anyhow, so that is perhaps why this community is different than a lot of newer Thich Nhat Hanh communities, and perhaps we are not orthodox. Which, to be honest with you, I take as a compliment. So again, a lot could be said, but any questions? Why don't we questions anything if people are interested in? Really, we have no agenda other than to share our experience. Yes.
What was the main language of communication? Because there were so many people from all over the world. How did you...
Well, it's very interesting. I would say English was the predominant presentation, but it's very interesting. There is multiple simultaneous translation going on. So if you could imagine a large meditation hall, maybe holding 500-600 people, right? There are all these little pods, right? With little signs saying French, German, Vietnamese, Chinese, Japanese. And so people who didn't speak English would come to these little pods, and they'd be these little kind of things they would be hooking their earphones into, and there would be somebody like me. So as who's ever giving the talk is giving the talk, you know, up front, there is somebody just very quietly translating simultaneously. So it's, they're probably 8, 10, 12 different languages being simultaneously translated. It used to be, sometimes there'd be retreats in English, but oftentimes, you know, Thai is fluent in English, obviously Vietnamese and French. So traditionally, oftentimes, he would give on different days a talk in a different language. You know, so those of us who didn't have the earphones one day would be having the earphones the next day. But for this, again, I just think because probably English is the one most common language these days, that pretty much everything was given in English. But certainly, as Angie pointed out, among the attendees, you know, the majority of the people were European, Asian, Central American, you know, South American. I mean, there were people from all over. And I would say, you know, Americans, Canadians were a small minority of people. Yes, Nancy. Yes.
You know, I didn't know what the talk was going to be, and I saw this morning that you were going to be speaking about the experience, so I got this real quick and came, knowing that I really appreciated hearing it. But I appreciated it even more than I knew I would. And I guess I would like to hear how you all see the experience you bring back, enriching us and our community. Or do you know yet?
So let me just repeat, I'm getting the signal from up there. This is being recorded. So the question is, Nancy's enjoyed certainly hearing it, but she wonders what people's ideas about what is relevant to our community that we are bringing back. So...
One thing I mentioned briefly that I thought was interesting and relevant was the idea of families. This is something that we brought up here maybe a year and a half ago, the idea of, you know, within the FCM community, having families of practitioners so that when someone becomes a new member or joins the community, that they would become part of this family, you know, of maybe a dozen or so other people. And that together these families would help each other really connect with all that we have to offer, both from a Dharma perspective and also from a community perspective. It's interesting when you bring up the idea of family in America, sometimes that has negative connotations for people. They hear family, and maybe I didn't have such a wonderful relationship with my family of origin. So we kind of put it aside. Maybe it was a little premature, but I found that at Plum Village, the families really looked out for each other, and they also were assigned certain, what we call selfless service areas together, and it really helped take care of the community. So I thought that was wonderful. One other thing that struck me was in our evening meditations, they did the earth touchings just about every night. And the earth touchings, those of us who are a little more scientifically inclined really would kind of like the new versions of the earth touchings. They're very much of connection with the earth, from stardust to creation of the planet through evolution. But really, I think we're quite profound in feeling connected. So there were some practices like that that I thought could be very meaningful to come back to the community.
You know, there are some specific practices like earth touching that I think it would be wonderful to find ways to incorporate more into our practices, including deep relaxation. We had every afternoon when there wasn't another program, which there usually wasn't, there was a group deep relaxation. The other, you know, maybe there are two other things. One is I was really taken by talking with people, and this is mostly from smaller European countries like Ireland and Finland, Holland, I think, where they actually have a coordinating body over all their sanghas. They're small enough that they can do that. And they have very formal programs of training for people who are going to take roles within their community of leading activities. And I thought, you know, maybe we can learn something from that about being a little more intentional and systematic in how we train people and prepare people to take on roles in our community. And finally, like I said before, it was just very meaningful for me to connect with other people and with the who are doing these practices all over the world and the monastics. So, you know, maybe there might be ways, and I would, you know, I think everybody would find that experience very wonderful to be able to connect directly. So maybe there are ways we can bring some monastics or bring people who are doing these practices in other places to our community.
One other thought I had as Diane was sharing is I am responsible for the newsletter each week for Mindfulness Matters, and so every so often I'll get something from Plum Village and we might incorporate it or reprint a little bit of it. But I left feeling like, you know, rather than feeling like we're occasionally incorporating something, I'd like to, from a communication perspective, find creative ways for us to really feel part of this larger community, to feel more connected with the information that we share so that we do, again, feel part of something which is very powerful and profound internationally, this great practice community. So we'll be looking for ways and would love to, you know, have any suggestions or help in finding ways for us to connect more broadly, because there are a lot of people throughout the world that are very concerned and creating groups to look at care of people who are sick with chronic illnesses. Mindfulness and education is very big internationally. A lot of what we're doing and things we haven't thought of are really very active in the international community, and we can be part of that, which is really wonderful.
Yes, let me just say quickly, I did do a trial balloon on the idea of families a year and a half ago. It kind of bombed. I didn't realize how much opposition I would run into, both people who feel they're already overcommitted, and two, didn't like the word families. As Angie said, you know, many people in the West have, you know, such negative views about families, the idea about getting into another one. You know, it's like they're trying to get out of their current one, you know what I mean? So, but again, now that some other people have been to Plum Village, you understand. That I always thought that was a very meaningful way that when you would attend, as the community there grew from where it just used to be 100 people or 75 people, so everyone, we kind of knew each other, but as it began to be 400 and 600 and 800, the idea of having these smaller families, and basically the families would take responsibility for certain jobs, such as working in the kitchen or taking care of the meditation hall. Our family happened to be in charge of sanitizing. All the dishes night after they were done had to be put through a sanitizer, so our family was sanitizing after all the meals. And plus, we would eat together, our meals together, in silence. And then sort of every other day in the afternoon, there would be sort of a sharing around, you know, what the presentations had been that morning. So this would all go on within the family. So again, it created this kind of within this larger setting, this more intimate, personal way. And, you know, as our community has grown from that, we have over 200 members. That was my idea, but maybe we'll try again with new inspiration. Yes. Nancy, then Alex.
I was at Plum Village about 2 years ago, right before I had a stroke. Mm-hmm. And he had retreated. Got some pneumonia and things like that. And it seemed like there was a real concern, at least among the lay people, about leadership in the whole organization and what's going to happen to Todd. And there was sort of even this sort of kind of, when we went, I was in lower and we went up to upper, like, who's going to be the Dharma in there? Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like, sort of, you know, what's going to happen in this organization? I just wondered what you know about, since that happened, about leadership and how they organize things, and is there a concern, not a concern?
Yeah, again, so the question is, Nancy said she was in Plum Village a couple of years ago. This is before Ty had a stroke, but when he was already beginning to get sick, and you know, his mortality was now becoming a reality. So questions of succession and continuation, yeah, that is a major issue within the monastic community. Not publicly talked about, but very, very concerned of theirs. You know, their father has left them in a certain way, and one day their mother, Sister Chong Kong, will leave them. Actually, they almost were going to cancel this retreat because they weren't sure about whether they could pull it off. Thay has not gone the route, the traditional route. Thich Nhat Hanh, he's called Thay, teacher, has not gone the traditional route of appointing a successor. He really has said his community is his continuation. So, and in this case, it's all of us, but, you know, really holding the lineage is his monastic community. And so, you know, they're struggling to find their way. But in hearing the talks, you know, there's a lot of good people there who have trained with him and really have gotten it by osmosis, if not by actual experience. So it is a transition, you know, how it's going to proceed without him. So it's interesting. It's interesting times for them. And they also know they're going to have to develop new forms. There was a very strong sense from the monastic community of more collaboration with the lay community. That was very clear. You know, that they Thay Nhat Hanh has been an energy holder, you know, for this community. And so it's he's no longer going to be that. So... yeah, so it's a time of change for them. And in terms of over the years, many years, I always invite many of my dear brothers and sister monastics who I know well to come here. The problem is, it was pointed out, they are very busy, 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 and their life is not their own. I mean, they as monastics, they are under the control of their community, and so they just can't go, oh, I want to go to, you know. And over the years, several of them, senior ones who I've invited here who want to come, at the last moment they can't come, because Thich Nhat Hanh would, Thay would tell you, you know, there's been so much explosion of growth, you know, they're off to Thailand, or they're off to Singapore, or, they're, you know, or he's going on tour. But I did make a strong pitch to Sister Gina, who is now an elder, she's emeritus of the community, who's a dear old friend of mine, to come to Florida. So her eyes lit up. So maybe I'd love to get her to come here and stay, and she did say she would, but I've been told that before, so we'll see what happens. But yeah, I would love to have more connection. Yes, Heather, Alex?
Well, I was actually going to ask a similar question in terms of the future, because you have this unique perspective of seeing this fun village phenomenon evolve. But because of the paradox of the charismatic leader, mm-hmm. You have someone that's as dynamic as Thich Nhat Hanh, who is not going to be around forever, and how that's addressed. I was wondering if you thought you would carry some of those thoughts to this particular summit as well.
Again, this is for the recording, this is a continuing question about continuation. It's sort of like, do you remember, for those who are familiar with the life of the Buddha, and I'm not saying that Thich Nhat Hanh is the Buddha, but he is Buddha-like. For those who are familiar with the story of the Buddha, he taught for 50 years, right? And he taught, and he had many, many students who heard many, many teachings. But after his passing, the monastics were concerned about continuation. So they had these great meetings, councils they were called, the first, second, third council, where they were kind of looking at, first of all, what were the Buddha's teachings? And so they kind of codified them, which were real teachings and which weren't, who carries it on and stuff like that. So it's sort of like that now. So it'll be interesting to see. And I think, like everything else, there will be the orthodox, more institutional continuation, and there'll be other kinds of continuations. Since he was very much a free thinker and very original, and some of that was transmitted too. So we'll see. Other questions? Yes, Diane. You're talking about the monks and the nuns?
Yes.
Well, they're monks and nuns. So, and they really, celibacy and things like that are what they live by. So, in that sense, they're not living together.
I understand that. I was just wondering about lifestyle.
Well, again, there always has been a lot of equality within the Thich Nhat Hanh community because of who he is. So it's definitely not hierarchical like you find in other Buddhist countries, where there is a clear hierarchy where the monks are one, if not 21 steps higher than the nuns. That doesn't go on. If anything, I would say over the years it's almost been the opposite. the nuns have been a very powerful influence and major. It's like Sister Gina and Sister Annabelle Chong Kong, Sister Chong Kong have all been major forces after Thay. So I think that kind of equality is definitely there in that community, in terms of responsibility, in terms of teaching. Now again, how's that going to play out? It's because one of the things that's happened, of course, in the last decade or so is, a real influx of Vietnamese monks and nuns into his community. And they're different than even the westernized or overseas Vietnamese. So they may bring a different kind of energy, which will probably play out. But in terms of the kind of way he has structured it, there is real equality. And yet they have their own, the monks have their monasteries, the nuns have their nunneries. And like you said, I mean, for talks, everybody mixes, right? it's really more at and in meditation in the morning and evening in the monastery. The monks kind of had the center row, but otherwise lay people, men or women, could be anywhere around them. In the talks, everything was equal. The only times I think it goes on is when there's formal ceremonies, like ordinations and stuff like that, where they do the men on one side and the women on the other side, which again does feel strange to us. But again, that's part of the, it's not Buddhist, it's Vietnamese Buddhist traditions. Yes, last but not least.
I just wondered, was there any music? I mean, 2000 music was such a wonderful presence, as you mentioned, with men and women.
Right. Yeah, so the question is about music, and it's very traditional now and continues to be that when before the formal Dharma talk of the day, the monks and nuns come up on the stage, so to speak, and they sing as a choir. And every day would be different. So that continues on. There is some singing and songs, not as much as in past years when I've been there. Sort of a lot of singing with everybody, but it certainly goes on. And there is music. There's this wonderful monk, Fap Lin, who's British, who's a composer. And a number of the monks and nuns are ex-musicians and there's a Japanese nun who was a first violinist from some Japanese orchestra. And so they play a lot for themselves. And at the festivities, they did this wonderful song. And this American ex-monk, Michael, sang this original composition by Fap Lin, who was a composer and a musician. Actually, when I... was invited to see Thay this past December when he was getting treatment in San Francisco. Fap Lin was his sort of attendant. And Fap Lin is also a wonderful musician, both cellist and pianist. And he told me he would play every day for Thay. Thay loved to hear him play. And Thay would love to hear people play music for him, so the violinist, and they would. So that was very much part of his life. He loved music. So good. So why don't we end for today? Thank you. Now, but maybe over the coming weeks, there are these. They put out this 40 tenets of Plum Village, so already they're beginning to synthesize Thay's teaching, and I will probably teach from them over the coming months. But in the introduction that was written by the Vulture Peak team that were overseeing the retreat. In presenting these 40 tenets of the Plum Village tradition, they had this quote from Thay. It is possible that our way of looking, excuse me, it is possible that our way of looking today will change in order to adapt to a deeper and more relevant way of looking tomorrow. In being faithful to the open and undogmatic stance of Buddhism, Plum Village always holds the door wide open for change, so never has a rigid and dogmatic attitude that its way of seeing things is right. This way of looking is practiced regularly in order to remove the obstacle of knowledge. This means knowledge like thinking your knowledge is the only knowledge, and always to have the opportunity to go forward. In this way, Buddhism changes, adapts, and progresses in the same way as science does in order to serve humankind more effectively all the time. So I just wanted to read that from Thich Nhat.